Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Harriet Wistrich. She's a solicitor of 20-plus years' experience working with the renowned civil liberties firm Birnbaum Pierce Limited. She's the winner of the Liberty Human Rights Lawyer of the Year Award 2014 and Legal Aid Lawyer of the Year 2018. She founded the Center for Women's Justice in 2016, a new multi-partner organization aimed at bringing cases holding the state to account in relation to violence against women and girls. She's also an active member of the Police Action Lawyers Group, Inquest Lawyers Group, Justice for Women, and is a trustee of the charity, the Emma Humphreys Memorial Prize. So first, thank you for your work, and second, thank you for being on the program.
You're welcome.
So let's start with a very brief introduction to sort of the status of male violence against women right now.
Sure. Well, the gathering of statistics and evidence from around the world is that it is a global endemic problem. In the UK, there is all sorts of statistical information about how women are, you know, murdered in domestic violence. Rape is a crime of impunity in relation to certain types of victims where, you know, those with particular vulnerabilities, like those with mental health problems and learning disabilities, they're very, very rarely ever prosecuted or convicted. And just generally, conviction rates are very low across the board, really, in violence against women. So there is a failure of the state to hold men to account around violence against women. And women are also find themselves often criminalized by the state, that's sometimes where they fight back, or where violent men are able to use mechanisms that are designed to protect women from violence and abuse to actually get them arrested and prosecuted. That's the sort of evidence that I've been working around and picking up in my own legal practice, and it's something that I'm aiming to challenge through the work of the Centre for Women's Justice.
What did you mean a moment ago when you said that men use laws that are set up to protect women to actually harm them? I'm sorry, I'm misquoting you so badly.
That's fine. I guess what I've seen and what working together in collaboration with those who work directly on the front line supporting victims of violence is that there are kind of too many cases, really, where, say, a woman is being physically or otherwise attacked by a man, calls out the police, she's in a hysterical state. When the police arrive, seems very calm and just says, well, she's mad and she's trying to harm me. And she ends up being arrested rather than him. That's the sort of example that a lot of organisations supporting victims of abuse have come across. So those men who are fairly on the ball, you know, are sometimes able to persuade the law enforcement agencies that they're the victims rather than the woman, and the woman sometimes gets arrested. The other thing that picked up on is in a number of cases where a woman reports a rape or a sexual assault, and the evidence is a bit all over the place, possibly because she's reported it late, she's very confused. There are all sorts of things that happen that cause rape complainants sometimes to put across their cases in ways that may give rise to the possibility of doubting her credibility. And in some cases where that's happened, women are being arrested and prosecuted for perverting the course of justice and sent to prison in some cases. That is and I've looked at a few of those cases, And they're usually women who've got quite serious mental health problems who are actually being penalised and prosecuted for coming forward to make complaints of rape, where their stories are a bit all over the place. Doesn't mean that they're actually lying, but because we know that a lot of rape complainants, victims of rape, through a variety of reasons to do with shame and trauma, their accounts can sound bizarre sometimes. It doesn't mean they're not telling the truth, but the way in which our criminal justice system deals with it means that they're sometimes open to prosecution, and that's a very, very worrying development. I've also seen cases where men have used legal remedies like family court remedies, like non-molestation orders, or report, you know, obtaining injunctions against women, and sometimes even using that as a form of stalking by constantly getting them arrested, or a case that I dealt with where the police officer was the husband of a woman who and they had become estranged and were in a custody battle, and he kept getting her arrested, setting her up to get her arrested. So they're sort of those are the sorts of cases, I mean, that I've seen and come across, which are very concerning. Obviously, also women who are being physically assaulted or victims in violent relationships fighting back, and I've dealt with a few cases where women have ended up killing and have been convicted of murder, even though they're victims of serious domestic violence.
So can you talk for a moment about the history of the organization, the Center for Women's Justice, and the history of your legal history in terms of this? How did the Center for Women's Justice actually get started?
Well, it's only been going for about 3 years. I have been a solicitor, a lawyer, working around the area of holding the state to account, mainly challenging the police, for quite a number of years. And I also have been involved in a campaign group called Justice for Women, which was specifically focused around the issue of women who kill and are convicted of murder, women who've been subjected to violence and abuse, who killed the abuser, if you like. So I kind of had that background, and through my legal work, so the sort of cases I was doing more generally could include anything from they weren't necessarily about violence against women, could be about men being wrongly arrested. A lot of issues around, you know, kind of racism and policing, and people and inquest cases where people die in custody. Or I also some years ago represented the family of Jean-Charles de Menezes, who was the Brazilian man who was shot by the police. So I did a more general practice, sort of civil rights practice. But because of my interest in feminism, I did develop. Was particularly interested in cases around violence against women and state accountability. And about 2010, 2011, I was approached by two women who were victims of the taxi driver John Warboys. I don't know if your listeners are familiar with that case, but he was a black taxi driver in London who drugged and sexually assaulted or raped over 100 women in the back of his black cab over a period of a number of years. And during that period, over 6 women came forward to report him. No, sorry, 10 women, I think, came forward to report him to the police. And each time the police didn't take action, or at least they did an initial investigation, but they dropped the case early on. And had they done their job properly, and had they believed the women as they, you know, and followed through properly, he would have been potentially prevented from attacking all those women. It was only after a long period where a police officer realised the pattern of offending, and he was eventually prosecuted and sent to prison. So I was approached by two of his victims who had reported him at the time, and we were very angry that the police hadn't taken them seriously. And we brought a civil action against the police for their failures to undertake a proper investigation. In UK law, you cannot sue the police in negligence for failures to investigate. So we used the Human Rights Act, and we argued that this was a violation of their rights under Article 3 of the European Convention of Human Rights, which says that you shall not be subjected to inhumane and degrading treatment or torture, and that the state has duties around preventing its citizens from being subjected to that. So we were able to argue that these women had been subjected to inhumane and degrading treatment in the form of rape, and that the police's duties extended not only to having a system of laws to protect citizens from that, but also from undertaking an effective investigation. That case eventually went all the way to the Supreme Court. At this year, it was found, it was held that there was a duty under Article 3. So it's quite an important precedent around the issue of violence against women, because it does establish a duty to investigate serious crimes of violence and rape. So that case and a number of others I've been involved with, it was quite clear that there weren't very many lawyers around who were doing that sort of case. And yet, because I'd sort of taken up those cases, I was aware that there was a huge demand. And also because of my connection with feminist activists and the women's movement more generally, I was aware of the level of need and demand, and the fact that women weren't using legal remedies really for accountability. So although there were organisations campaigning or lobbying for political change, sometimes you would have that change come around. You know, you would have laws, you would have policies, you would have practical guidance given to the criminal justice agencies, but they just weren't doing their job. And that was the case in the War Boys case. Police had all the guidance there, they just weren't following it. So what the aim really of the Centre for Women's Justice is to kind of broaden the potential for using legal remedies to hold the state to account around violence against women and girls by bringing strategic litigation challenges, and also by building up expertise amongst lawyers who have a commitment to challenging violence against women and girls, and connecting them with people who need help, and particularly through frontline organisations supporting women who are victims of violence and abuse.
Something that's kind of breaking my heart about everything you're saying is that, you know, you formed this organisation 3 years ago because of a need, and people who know my work know that my father was extremely violent, and my mother went through all of this back in the 60s and experienced these same things where, you know, she learned not to call the police because the police would do exactly what you said, that there was my mother would be in tears and my father is perfectly calm and collected, and the best she could hope for was the cops would tell him to walk around the block, but more likely they would say, wow, you're kind of nuts. Obviously, he's looking fine. And the reason I bring all this up is because that was in the late 60s, early 70s. And while there certainly are more battered women's shelters now than there were then, it breaks my heart to hear that 3 years ago there was, and of course I knew this already, but to know that 3 years ago things had changed little enough that there was the need for this.
Yeah, I mean, it is very depressing. I mean, I think, you know, we need to recognise that there has been some really important progress. I mean, at one stage, women didn't even talk about it. It was domestic abuse, obviously child abuse, rape. You know, there was a lot more silence around it, and there is more possibility of speaking out, I think, and there are more laws that tackle it, and there is more training and understanding. So hopefully things have moved on a bit from that time, but the reality is that there's still a massive need, and I think the problem is, you know, we can have all the laws in the world, but you have to have real commitment to and ways of holding those to account that don't put the laws and the training and the guidance into practice. So you kind of need a whole kind of framework, and I see the role of, you know, the centre and kind of legal challenge really as one part of an overall strategy to try and make things change, if you like. And I think it can empower those, you know, if you are able to, if you know what the law is and you're able to seek recourse to legal remedies, I think it you know, it gives you a bit of power, empowerment. You don't necessarily, it's not always very easy to use, also can be very expensive, you know, that there are all sorts of issues about the cost of it, but if you can, you know, if you have that knowledge, it's something better than not having the potential to recourse to it, I suppose.
So this might not be a fair question, and you can let me know if it isn't, but how much, you said earlier that you're not allowed to sue the police for negligence, and what percentage, and that's the part that's not fair, what percentage of the failure of the police do you think is, in these sorts of cases, is due to sort of the generalized incompetence that would be the same as if you take your car to the shop and they just do a crap job of fixing it? You know, a lot of people just aren't very good. And how much of it is a larger cultural contempt for women and sort of the fact that we're involved in, or that we're living in this whole larger system that has a generalized disrespect or contempt for women?
I think the two things go together, don't they? I mean, if you cared about women, you wouldn't be incompetent. I think the you know, there's a mixture. The failures come down to a mixture. There's a lot of those in policing who just don't, you know, we live in a culture that you know, where this is very pervasive. These attitudes are very pervasive. And, you know, and that then infects those who are working in those organisations. And, you know, if you don't care, then you're not necessarily going to do your job properly. You know, if you did care, then hopefully you would do your job properly. I mean, there may be, you know, errors, which is different, or there may be, you know, kind of lack of intelligence or ability or whatever, but that's not what we see. What we see when we see cases that fail, it's because there's a lack of will, really. I mean, there's also a lack of resourcing, I would say. You know, police, you know, particularly these days with the, you know, massive cuts caused by austerity and a conservative government and Brexit and everything, mean that they're under-resourced in some ways. But, you know, it is also about a commitment, you know, just to achieve the right thing. And you can achieve, you know, much, much better results with a bit of will and effort.
And so what changes have you seen in policing since you and more broadly the Center for Women's Justice and others have been, as it were, holding their feet to the fire? Have you seen tangible changes from their inside in the last 3 years?
That is a very difficult question to answer, I think, because, you know, I think I think it's a very difficult thing to measure, basically. All I can say on a personal level is that, you know, having gained a bit of a reputation for bringing such cases, I suppose my name and or the name of the centre does sort of make people sit up and be a bit more alert. So I think that's the only aspect of the question that I can answer at the moment. I think it will take a long time to measure that. But you know, if more women are aware of potential challenges, and you know, and if we're successful in some of the strategic litigation challenges. I mean, as an organisation, we've only just started, you know, in the last few months, looking at strategic litigation cases. So, and these cases can take years. So, I think it's very difficult to measure. Really, it's going to be a long term, you know, objective. I can only hope that it will make a difference. But it's something you have to keep. Unfortunately, I suppose more broadly, you know, like with, you know, the sort of downs. Well, you know, the difficult side of it is that we see again and again, not just with cases around violence against women, but cases about, you know, holding the state to account. Like for example, in inquest cases where somebody dies in custody, and you have this whole inquiry and lessons, and then you have this sort of lessons will be learnt, and you know, there seems to be some outcome which hopefully is positive, and then you see the same failings happen over and over again. So I think, you know, there is, you know, you just have to keep fighting it, I think. And the more people who take up cases and fight, the, you know, it's a huge inconvenience to and a cost to the police or to whichever agency it is you're challenging. So that's something they'll want to avoid. And so, you know, the more people who do it, the more you might be able to achieve change, I think.
So I'm thinking a couple of things. One of them is that there's sort of, it falls into a couple categories here that you can have people who, I was on a plane decades ago just chatting with the person in the seat next to me and asked her what she did, and she said, "Well, I work as in the DA's district attorney's office as a prosecutor." And I said, "Okay," you know, didn't think much of it. And then we chat more, and I said, "Well, why did you start doing this work?" And she said, "Because I became a district attorney specifically because I want to put batterers in prison."
Yeah.
And she had, you know, to use the cliche, she had that fire in her belly that she was just gonna she was gonna do this.
Yeah.
So that's one level of doing your job. Another level of doing your job would be, oh, yeah, I got to do it, and I'll do it. And then the sort of third level would be where you really sort of actively sabotage because you have contempt for women. And it seems like one of the things that would certainly help the police is if there were a lot more people in it who actually – and one of the things you're trying to do, if I'm – let me know if I'm incorrect – is you're trying to push them from the bottom level of having contempt to at least doing their job. And then what would be nice is if there were a bunch of them who actually had the fire in their belly that they were,
absolutely,
I'm going to stop this thing.
I agree. I mean, there are, you know, there are people who do. And when you see, I mean, with my work, you sometimes see, you know, really, really good examples of policing. I mean, I'm kind of, you know, some of the cases, so we have a separation, well, like you do in the States, I think you have a separation between the police and the prosecution service. And sometimes, you know, there are a few cases at the moment that one of the agencies that we're bringing a few challenges around is the Crown Prosecution Service. And sometimes that's in relation to cases where the police have actually done a really great investigation and expected the case to proceed to a prosecution. And the CPS have said no and stopped it. And, you know, that we're looking at the moment at a series of cases about the police, about the prosecution dropping rape prosecutions. And so sometimes you see really good police officers who you know, completely, you know, doing a good job or an excellent job, being thwarted by other systemic issues. And sometimes you get, you know, sometimes there are good prosecutions or, you know, there are results where you know, bad perpetrators are held to account. So it doesn't always fail. There are good people there, but there's a lot of rotten, you know, it's more than the odd rotten apple. There's a lot of, as you say, they fall into three categories, I think. There's some very bad. there's some, you know, just people doing their job, what's more than my job's worth type. And then there's some good people. So like any area really. Same as lawyers. Plenty of crap lawyers around.
And then part of the problem too, it seems, is the larger, what does the larger culture, the larger police culture in this case, support? And I'm thinking, I used to be a teacher at a maximum security prison. I taught creative writing. And part of our training process was to undergo a sexual harassment prevention course. And it was one of the most awful things I've ever seen, because the two teachers, it was very clear they were doing this because all new employees have to go through this training, but they didn't care. In fact, their first statement was, we need to let everybody know this is a sexual harassment prevention course, not a sexual harassment course, because we know everybody in this room already knows how to sexual harass. Ha ha ha, big joke. And the whole thing was just sort of little male bonding jokes like that. So it seems that I just want to let you loose on the notion of that sort of larger systemic culture of ha-ha, you know, rape jokes and ha-ha, it's not taking the issue of men's violence against women seriously.
Yeah, well, as you identify, it's a massive problem. And, you know, unless we can really radically change our cultural attitudes around that, then, you know, we're going to be constantly infected with that kind of attitude wherever you go, because that's where, you know, people exist in a patriarchal culture, if you like. And, you know, it happens all the time. I would say, you know, certainly the police force are, and most of the criminal justice agencies are kind of institutionally sexist. And in fact, that there's another, you know, big case I'm involved with concerns undercover police officers, a lot of whom were having sexual relationships with people they were spying on. And this has sort of come to light in the last few years as a huge scandal. But you know, obviously they're not supposed to do that. And actually you could say that amounts to, you know, sexual assault, to deceive somebody and pretend that you're an activist, whereas actually you're just spying on them and then have sex with them. And that was, you know, seemed to be, you know, kind of, you know, normal within these units, which were gathering intelligence on, you know, people involved in you know, often environmental activism, social justice activism, and you know, left-wing political activism. But the attitudes, you know, within the, you know, and they, you know, certain types of policing is very kind of macho as well, you know, like, you know, undercover policing will be seen as like quite a, you know, a kind of glamorous type of job, being a spy or whatever, and with it goes a, you know, often a very sexist attitudes towards women.
And whatever happened to those police officers who in those cases practice sex by deception, really?
Mm-hmm. What's happened to them?
Yes.
Well, this is still the subject of ongoing litigation. We have a public, supposed, so-called public inquiry in this country into undercover policing at the moment, because it's been a huge scandal. And so far, no officer has been prosecuted for any offence. And there's been one case where an officer has been, has lost his job as a result of misconduct. You know, that's it. In fact, we've got a case coming up in the next few weeks where we're challenging the Crown Prosecution Service over their decision not to prosecute one of the officers for either misconduct in public office or a sexual offence in relation to him forming an intimate sexual relationship with a woman by deception. And that's an example we have in the UK of inequality, of discrimination against women, because we see women being sent to prison for having sex with another woman where they are impersonating a man. And that's seen as a serious crime deserving a prison sentence. But a police officer impersonating an activist while spying is just seen to be doing his job with no sanction, apparently. So we're trying to challenge that at the moment.
And I remember reading something in the paper about, in the news about those cases where someone from the police side said, well, gosh, all these activists are all sleeping with each other all the time, which means we have to do this to fit into the culture, which struck me immediately as the classic, that's nothing more nor less than the classic, she was wearing a short skirt, so she was asking for it. I mean, that's the classic victim blaming.
Yeah, I mean, it's totally outrageous and totally a kind of ridiculous excuse. I mean, even in, I mean, Kennedy, Mark Kennedy was one of the ones that was the first officer really to be exposed, who was spying on groups of, you know, kind of environmental activists mainly, and some of them did believe in open relationships, so they didn't believe that, you know, you could only have a sexual relationship with a person that you were married to, but. So there was not less, you know, there wasn't necessarily, you know, it could have been seen by, you know, some sort of sexist man coming in there and thinking, oh, this is a good opportunity for me to have lots of sex with women, and kind of completely and utterly undermining what the philosophy was about open relationships, which was about being very open and honest and talking about relationships and trying to challenge issues around, you know, jealousy and you know, that you own somebody that you have a sexual relationship. And here comes this bloke thinking he could have a bit of a field day having lots of sex. So, you know, completely outrageous. But in any event, of course, no officer had to have sex with anyone when they were undercover. I mean, first of all, they shouldn't have been, pretending, you know, spying and on groups like that in the first place. But and you know, why the police put so much resources into gathering evidence and putting someone deep in undercover in that way is another question. But insofar as they were doing that, there's actually no reason to have sex. They could have done, you know, not, you don't have to have sex with somebody. It's just completely nonsense. And you know, they sometimes come up with this excuse, well, you know, activists would test somebody out if they suspected they were a spy, and if they didn't have sex, then they would, you know, they would realize they were a spy, which is just utter rubbish.
Well, I have to tell you, I have been a grassroots environmental activist for 30 years, and I have to tell you, there are a large number of activists with whom I have never had sex. It's like this.
Really?
Yeah, imagine that. I have been to lots of protests where I went by myself and left by myself, and it's. I mean, the thing is just absurd, even on its face.
It's completely outrageous.
And my point really is that, and that this was printed in the news sort of straight-faced, and I was able to read it several thousand miles away. I mean, that's just, this is a sort of thing that if somebody tried to actually say it, I mean, the spokesperson actually said this, and then, so it was vetted at every level, which just reveals this complete level of contempt that we've been talking about. It's just...
Absolutely.
So I want to go a slightly different direction here and talk about justice for women. And... So two things. One is, I've read many places that when a woman attempts to leave her the partner who is battering her, that is oftentimes the most dangerous time for her. And the second thing I want to mention, I'm sorry, go ahead, please.
No, you're right. That's definitely the sort of evidence suggests, what the evidence suggests,
And then the second thing is, I don't know what the numbers are now in the U.S., and I don't know what the numbers ever were in the UK. But in the United States, I remember about 15, 20 years ago reading that if a man beats a woman to death, the average sentence he would get would be 7 years. And if, on the other hand, a woman killed a man who was attempting to beat her to death, the average sentence she would get would be 20 years.
Mm.
And so I'm just releasing that, and now you go wherever you want with this.
Yeah, well, we're actually doing some research on that at the moment to try and, kind of get a kind of very clear overview. What I would say is at the time that we first set up Justice for Women, which was back in the early 90s, we did so because we became aware of a number of cases where women have been... So in the UK, if you're you have murder or manslaughter... Or you're acquitted, and murder carries a mandatory life sentence. That doesn't mean you spend the rest of your life in prison, but it means that if you're released, you have a tariff, a number of years you have to serve, and then after that you're eligible for parole. But if you're released, you're always subject to recall. You're on a life license. So being convicted of murder, is a very heavy duty result, if you're convicted. And then we have manslaughter, and there are a couple of defences to manslaughter where you're still guilty of an intention to kill or cause serious harm, but the sentence is mitigated either as a result of what's called diminished responsibility, which probably speaks for itself. It's you have to have a mental health diagnosis which diminishes your responsibility for the killing, or what was a defence used to be called provocation, has been slightly reformed. It's called loss of control, but that defence is whether you're provoked to lose your self-control, and if you're convicted of manslaughter, you can get a fixed term sentence, which can be anything from life in some circumstances, but more commonly to a number of years, or even sometimes a probation order in certain circumstances. So what we found, and the reason we set up Justice for Women, was we kept seeing men being acquitted of, men who had been violent, being acquitted of, and had killed their female partner, being acquitted of murder, and successfully relying on provocation, because, they say that she was having an affair or she was nagging him or something. We used to call it the nagging or shagging defence. or whilst women were not able to use that defence. So even though they were being beaten up on a regular basis or subject to controlling and coercive behaviour, they were not able to use that defence because it wasn't... They weren't necessarily reacting suddenly to the violence, so we sought to challenge that law. In fact, there was a slight change in the law, but it's difficult to see whether things have really changed. And I've done a number of appeals against murder convictions for women over the past 20 odd years. Who've been, sentenced to life imprisonment, and unfortunately, this keeps happening. Cases where women have been subjected to really awful violence and control, and are still being convicted of murder. I think possibly there's been a slight change over the years that I think men are less able to get away with it than they did in the past. So you see, I'd say you see more men being convicted of murder. At one stage, it seemed like they always got away with it. Now it seems less so. But I think, this is going back to your original theme, really, that the culture that we live in and the woman-hating culture, and where women commit a crime that's violent, they're very, very heavily judged for it, whereas men are often excused, and the kind of you know, so-called provocations they're subjected to are seen as mitigating in a way that violence isn't.
Which is really extraordinary when you think about it, or even when you don't think about it very much. That's pretty extraordinary.
Yeah. It is, and it's, you know, it is. I mean, that's the, you know, the depressing side, I suppose, of, you know, going back again to the question, you know, well, what results do you see as a result of, you know, of doing these legal cases? I think sometimes you do see changes, but then, you know, you know, if it's not constantly being highlighted and constantly campaigned around, things kind of move backwards again. And the other thing you see is that there's just always a back, you know, the more gain that women make, the more there's a backlash. And you've probably seen that, you know, this is, you know, horrifically highlighted in states recently in your Supreme Court case. Well, the whole kind of division between, you know, the Brett Kavanaugh thing, where, you just see, you know, on the one hand, there's this great movement forward around Me Too and Time's Up and all the rest of it, and more women speaking out. And on the other hand, there's a kind of coordinated fight back. And you know, we're in a kind of culture of a sex war in a lot of ways. You just see that all over. You know, we've made progress, but then there's more to lose. And so those that you know, unlike you, Derek, but the men who you know, want to hold on to their power are going to, you know, going to fight very hard and fight back. And I think that's the climate we're living in.
So, what can we have about 3 or 4 or 5 minutes left, and what can people both in the UK and in the rest of the world do who want to, I'm going to ask both locally and globally, so what can they do to support your particular work or the work of the Center for Women's Justice or Justice for Women, and then in a larger scale, what can both men and women, I should really say both women and men, put women first, do to stop this whole endemic violence against women?
Yeah. Well, you know, practical.
Yeah, so do that
thing
in 2 minutes.
Yeah, in terms of practical things to support the work, I mean, obviously, you know, financial donations are always welcome. Got a website, centreforwomensjustice.org.uk, but you know, and getting involved, sharing stories, sharing information on social media, you know, providing ideas and collaboration. You know, from the point of view of the centre, where, you know, we have a, you know, the approach is sort of underlying philosophy is kind of working collaboratively. So we don't see lawyers as the experts. We see, you know, the benefit of working together with those, you know, with survivors and those working on the front line, activists as well as academic experts, and, you know, the media where appropriate, to, you know, to build up, you know, to use our joint expertise. So, you know, we welcome input and sharing of information, you know, to build up our knowledge base and expertise. So I guess that's another practical way. What can men and women, or women and men, do more generally to stop violence, male violence? I mean, you know, just challenge it, keep fighting, keep talking to other people, and, you know, don't remain silent. Those sorts of things, I guess.
Well, is there anything else that you want to say to close? So if somebody says, oh, I heard this great interview today, and the other person says, what was it about? And then how would you, what do you want them to take home?
I suppose that, you know, don't give up, keep challenging, keep fighting. You know, from my own particular expertise, it's, you know, consider using legal challenges as a part of a fight to challenge the state where it fails. And, you know, that however hard things become, don't hide, don't go away, you know, get support from others, and keep speaking out about it, keep it up in the agenda. And you know, violence against women, you know, women's causes often seem to fall quite low down on the hierarchy of political causes, but it is, you know, one of the most fundamental things that, you know, if we don't get, you know, if we don't challenge violence against women, if we don't challenge, you know, male power, you know, we'll never change anything.
Well, thank you so much for all of your incredibly important work, and I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Harriet Wistrich. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.